Crime and Crime Again discusses true crime stories that may contain disturbing content. Listener discretion is advised. In this episode, I will be discussing disturbing acts of violence against women, including assault, rape, torture, and murder. Please proceed with caution. This case has very little information available. The vast majority of the details of this case that I'll be sharing with you were gathered from the episode of Disappeared called Spring Break Nightmare, which aired in November 2011. Beyond this short documentary by Investigation Discovery, there is virtually no other information about this case. With that said, let's get right into it. Colleen Emily Osborne was born on March 3, 1969. She spent most of her childhood living in Pennsylvania with her parents, and she was the youngest of six children. By the time she was 12 years old, she was the only one out of her siblings still living at home. Her parents' marriage had become unhealthy and rather volatile by this time. As the only one of her siblings still living with her parents, Colleen bore witness to the collapse of their marriage. According to her siblings, who were interviewed for the Disappeared episode, this likely deeply affected Colleen's behavior in a negative way. Colleen's mother, Frances Osborne, finally decided that after 25 years of marriage, it was time to leave, and she and a preteen Colleen moved to Florida for a new start. In March of 1984, Frances had just gotten a new job after being out of work for some time due to an illness. In just 2 years after initially moving to Florida, Colleen transferred schools three times. At one of these schools, she had made several good friends, but she had to transfer schools as her mother could no longer afford tuition, because again, she had been out of work for some time. At the latest school, which she was attending at the time of her disappearance, she was unhappy and frequently expressed to friends that she wished she could go back to her former school. Most preteens and teenagers develop, at least to some degree, a rebellious attitude, some worse than others. This is generally a result of intense hormonal changes and shifts that occur during these adolescent years, as well as the pressures and social dilemmas that most adolescents face in school and among their peers during this time in their lives. Oftentimes, however, this defiant behavior can be exacerbated by past or current traumas or their family life within their own homes. Colleen did indeed become rebellious and developed a tense, confrontational relationship with her mother, Frances, by the time she was 15 years old. This was likely the culmination of a natural teenage defiance, coupled with the emotional trauma of being subjected to her parents' failing marriage and ultimate separation. Not only that, it was likely jarring for Colleen to be uprooted and moved across the country at just 12 years old. One of Colleen's most notorious behaviors was skipping school, and this was a major point of contention in her relationship with her mother. Frances was also likely emotionally traumatized after having left a 25-year marriage and starting her entire life over with a preteen daughter states away from everything she had previously known. On top of all of that, she ended up facing an illness that left her unable to work and dealing with a lot of financial strain. On the morning of March 15, 1984, in Daytona Beach, Florida, Frances Osborne woke to see that her 15-year-old daughter was still in bed and had missed the school bus. Having just landed a new job, she couldn't afford to miss or be late for work, meaning that she wouldn't be able to take Colleen to school. She left bus money on the counter for Colleen and headed off to work. When Frances returned home hours later, she found the bus money still on the counter. Initially, she assumed that Colleen had skipped school once again, which was something they had argued about just the day before. Spring break was just starting in Daytona Beach, and it wouldn't have been unlike Colleen to head to the beach in lieu of going to school. They lived in a beachside apartment, so it would have been no trouble at all for Colleen to walk there, and the beach was definitely one of her favorite places. Another great love of Colleen's was music. A local venue called the Bandshell was hosting several concerts at the time, and Colleen had actually been marking concert dates in her calendar. Just the day before, on March 14th, she had actually defied her mother's wishes and went to a concert despite her mother telling her no, So it was definitely another possibility in her family's minds that she may have skipped school to attend another concert. They noted that there was in fact a concert being held that day, March 15th. Colleen did have a habit of running off to her siblings' nearby houses when her fights with her mother were particularly bad. She had even run away for a couple of days at a time, but only to her brother Bruce's house. Whenever she did this, she would typically leave a note telling her mother where she was. In fact, any time Colleen was intending to be gone for any period of time, she would leave a note. That day, however, Frances found no notes left behind by Colleen. Becoming increasingly concerned, Frances called Colleen's siblings, asking if they had heard from or seen her. But no one had any knowledge about her whereabouts, and no one had heard anything from her. The only items missing from Colleen's room seemed to be items that she would take to the beach, such as a swimsuit and flip-flops. Her house keys, money, and all of her makeup had been left behind. After 24 hours without word from Colleen, her family started to contact her friends, but none of them had any idea where she might be. No one could even confirm that she had been to the beach or a concert on March 15th, and no one reported seeing her at school at any point that day. The possibility that she had skipped school to simply attend a concert or lounge on the beach became less and less likely. In the 2 days after she disappeared, her family began making posters, with her picture on them and hanging them up around town. They also drove around areas they knew Colleen might have been or been seen, but no one had any information, and she was nowhere to be found. The family contacted police, but were told they would have to wait 48 hours before filing a missing persons report. On March 19th, 1984, her family officially reported Colleen as a missing person. Larry Lewis, the lead detective on Colleen's case, asked Frances if he could come to the apartment and gather items that may eventually prove to be useful as DNA evidence. He collected a hairbrush, a curling iron, and a teddy bear from Colleen's bedroom. One thing that struck me about this case is that Detective Lewis had the foresight to also use Colleen's nail polish collection as potential evidence. He painted a small spot of every single color of nail polish that she owned on a piece of paper, and recorded the brand and the name of that specific color. This was to be used in the event that they discovered a body that still had nail polish on the fingernails, so as to compare the colors. Detective Lewis also sent hair samples from Colleen's hairbrush and curling iron to the FBI to be stored for future use. Police didn't release Colleen's photo to the media until nearly a month after she disappeared. Almost immediately, tips began pouring in. On April 12, 1984, 28 days after Colleen vanished, a particularly promising tip comes in. A girl who had known Colleen came forward with a troubling account of March 15th. The girl said that on that day she had been hanging out with her boyfriend when a white man in his 30s, driving a blue sedan, pulled up and asked her to come over to his car. When she did, he told her that she had the potential to be a model and offered her $100 to come to his studio and pose for some photos. The girl declined and walked away. She recalled seeing this man driving away and turning onto Butler Boulevard, the street that Colleen lived on. The reason that this tip struck investigators was because at this time, in 1984, a nationwide manhunt was underway for a man who had spent the last month abducting, torturing, raping, and murdering women across the country. That man was Christopher Bernard Wilder. Christopher Wilder was born on March 13, 1945, in Sydney, Australia. His father was American and his mother Australian. There really isn't much known about his childhood. In 1963, Wilder pled guilty to the rape of a 13-year-old girl and was only sentenced to probation. He married in 1968, but his wife left him after only 1 week of marriage. In 1969, Wilder immigrated to the United States and became a successful real estate agent in Boynton Beach, Florida. Between 1971 and 1975, he was charged with numerous counts of sexual misconduct. In one case, he convinced a woman to come with him to pose for photos and raped her. This would later become his modus operandi. Somehow, Wilder never faced any jail time for his numerous sexual misconduct convictions. During a trip to Australia to visit his parents in 1982, he was charged with the sexual assault of 2 15-year-old girls. His parents bailed him out of jail, and he was allowed to return to the U.S. He never faced trial for these charges. His hearing date had been set for 1984. By 1984, Wilder was living in Florida as a contractor/construction worker and somewhat of a part-time race car driver. On February 26, 1984, a 20-year-old woman named Rosario Gonzalez was working at Miami Grand Racetrack, selling samples for a pharmaceutical company. When she wasn't working this temp job for the pharmaceutical company, she was working as a part-time model. Witnesses recalled Rosario leaving the racetrack around 1 p.m. with a white man in his 30s. She had been expected home to her parents' house in Homestead, Florida, between 5 and 6 p.m. that evening, but she never showed up, and she never picked up her last paycheck. She was also engaged to be married at the time. Her car was later found near DuPont Plaza, which I believe was in close relative proximity to the Miami Grand Racetrack where she was last seen. Christopher Wilder was a driver at the track that day. Elizabeth Kenyon, known to family and friends as Beth, was a 23-year-old teacher in Coral Gables, Florida. She worked with special needs children at a local high school and was a graduate of the University of Miami. She was also a former model. On March 5, 1984, Beth was last seen leaving the school parking lot around 3 p.m. Her family reported her missing to the Miami police on March 6th. However, they felt as though the police weren't doing enough to investigate her disappearance, so they hired private investigator Ken Whitaker and his son to look into Beth's case. A photo book was found in Beth's apartment that investigators thought may be useful. In that photo book was a picture of Beth with none other than Christopher Wilder. The two had previously dated, and Wilder even proposed to Beth. However, she declined his proposal, and her family says that this did indeed make Wilder angry. Whitaker traced her last movements to a gas station near the high school where she worked. An attendant at the gas station remembered seeing Beth the day she disappeared. He said that she had been talking with a man, and he identified that man from a picture in the photo book. It was Christopher Wilder. On March 11th, Whitaker contacted Wilder, but he denied knowing anything about where Beth might be. He actually invited Whitaker to come to his home to talk about Beth. However, when Whitaker showed up, Wilder was nowhere to be found. Beth's car was found at Miami International Airport, but there was no evidence that she had boarded any flights in the days since her disappearance. The family contacted the FBI seeking their help on March 12, 1984. Investigators strongly suspected that Christopher Wilder was involved in Beth's disappearance, and they developed a plan to try to get him to crack. They placed a story in the Miami Herald entitled, "Race Driver May Be Linked to Missing Models," written by Edna Buchanan and published on March 16, 1984. The article very plainly described Wilder without actually mentioning his name. However, nothing came of this article. On March 21, 1984, Miami FBI were notified that a woman had been abducted in Tallahassee and taken across state lines into Georgia. The woman had managed to escape her attacker, and the description that she provided to investigators matched Christopher Wilder. The fact that she had been taken across state lines during her abduction gave the FBI jurisdiction over the case and allowed them to open an investigation into Wilder. The victim was 19-year-old Linda Grover. On March 20th, she had been shopping at a mall in Tallahassee when she was approached by a man asking her if she would be interested in posing for photos as a model. He asked her to come with him to his car to take a look at his portfolio, and Linda obliged. As they approached his car, he suddenly claimed that he had left his portfolio at his photography studio, so he asked her to instead come with him to the studio, but Linda became hesitant. Her attacker pushed her into his car and hit her in the head, rendering her unconscious. When he noticed that she was beginning to wake up, he stopped the car and dragged her out, strangling her until she fell unconscious again. When she awoke, she was in a cheap motel room, wrapped in a sleeping bag. She'd been tied to the bed, and her eyes had been glued shut. This motel was in Bainbridge, Georgia. The man tortured Linda for hours, electrocuting her with an extension cord when she resisted. During these several hours, he also brutally raped her repeatedly. At some point, Linda managed to break free, and she ran into the bathroom, locking herself in. She began to bang on the walls and scream for help, which sent her attacker into a panic, and he fled the scene. Linda was able to pick Christopher Wilder out of a photo lineup. She positively identified him as her abductor and rapist. The FBI raided his home, but he was already long gone. Christopher Wilder was now a wanted fugitive, and he also became the prime suspect in the disappearances of both Rosario Gonzalez and Elizabeth Kenyon. On March 23, 1984, in Beaumont, Texas, Wilder abducted 23-year-old Terry Walden, a wife and mother who was studying to become a nurse. He stabbed her to death and left her body in a canal, where she was found on March 26th. His car was found a few miles away from where he abducted her. 21-year-old Suzanne Logan was shopping at a mall in Oklahoma City on March 25, 1984, when she was abducted by Christopher Wilder. He drove her to a motel in Newton, Kansas, and then to Junction City, Kansas, the next day. Again, he stabbed her to death, and she was found on March 27th. On March 28th, Wilder checked into a hotel in Rifle, Colorado, using a stolen card. The FBI thought they finally had him cornered, but when they converged on the hotel with the intent to take Wilder into custody, they discovered that he had already left, hours prior to their arrival. 18-year-old Cheryl Bonaventura was abducted from Grand Junction, Colorado, on March 29, 1984. A witness placed Cheryl at a diner with Christopher Wilder in Silverton, Colorado, that night. Restaurant staff stated that the two claimed to be on their way to Las Vegas. Another witness placed Cheryl with Wilder at the Four Corners Monument on March 30th. The Four Corners Monument is the point where Colorado, Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico meet. Wilder then took Cheryl to a motel in Page, Arizona, where she was tortured and raped, just as Wilder's previous victims had been. On April 1, 1984, a mall in Las Vegas was hosting a fashion show for 17 Magazine, where modeling scouts could find potential new talent. One of the contestants in the fashion show, 17-year-old Michelle Korfman, disappeared after walking the stage in the event. The FBI asked those in attendance to provide them with any photos that they had taken at the event. In one photo, Michelle Korfman is seen posing at the end of the runway, and in the background is Christopher Wilder, watching her intently. The FBI publicly announced on April 5, 1984, that Christopher Wilder had been added to the 10 most wanted list. 16-year-old Tina Marie Rosico disappeared from Torrance, California on April 4, 1984. She had been coerced by Wilder into posing for photos for him. After taking the photos in a park, Wilder abducted Tina at gunpoint and forced her into his car, and he then drove to El Centro, California. In a motel room, Wilder tied Tina to the bed and tortured her by electrocution. He repeatedly raped her. Tina suffered 6 days of violent torture and rape. Wilder ended up keeping Tina alive, and it was later discovered that this was because he believed he could use her to lure other victims. Tina was forced to travel with Wilder through Arizona, Missouri, and Illinois. Eventually, Wilder made his way to Indiana. On April 10, 1984, in Merrillville, Indiana, Tina was forced to lure 16-year-old Donette Wilt to Wilder's car, where he abducted her. Wilder forced Tina to watch as he tortured and raped Donette for 2 days. Tina also likely suffered further torture and rape during this time. On April 12th, Wilder traveled with his two victims to Penn Yan, New York, where he attempted to suffocate Donette and then stabbed her twice, leaving her to die in a wooded area near a busy road. Miraculously, Donette was able to tie her jeans around her wounds as a tourniquet, and she managed to grab the attention of a passing truck driver, who quickly drove her to a hospital in Penn Yan. Donette underwent surgery and survived her nightmare. She informed police that Wilder was heading for Canada. After leaving Donette wounded in the woods, Wilder continued on his homicidal rampage. He still had not released Tina. 33-year-old Beth Dodge was walking to her car in a mall parking lot in Victor, New York, when Wilder forced her into his car at gunpoint. He then forced Tina to follow behind them, driving Beth's Pontiac Firebird. Shortly after, Wilder shot Beth and left her in a gravel pit, fleeing the scene in her car. Beth is presumed to be the only victim of Wilder's that was not tortured or raped. He then drove to Logan International Airport in Boston, Massachusetts, where he finally let Tina go and bought her a ticket to Los Angeles. In Beverly, Massachusetts, he attempted to abduct another woman at gunpoint, but failed. I just want to make a note about Tina Marie Rosico. I've seen many, many comments from people in various YouTube comment sections or Reddit posts where people are likening Tina to Wilder, saying that she's no different from Wilder. Many people speculate that she had numerous opportunities to escape, or that she didn't have to lure Donette, she could have gone to mall security, or that she didn't have to help Wilder, that she didn't have to do anything for him, and that she chose to. I vehemently disagree with all of these sentiments. Tina Marie Rosico was just as much a victim as every other victim that Wilder abducted, tortured, raped, and murdered. This 16-year-old girl suffered 6 days of torture and rape in a motel room by Christopher Wilder. She then spent several more days traveling with Wilder by force, luring a victim into his hands, and being forced to watch as he did to this girl exactly what he did to Tina. He probably continued to torture and rape Tina as well. Tina Rosico had no choice. She was a young girl, terrified, scared to death, mentally, physically, psychologically, sexually abused, and I think it is absolutely vile to blame her for her ordeal or to treat her as though she's the same as Christopher Wilder, as though she was an accomplice, and not every bit a victim as every other woman that Christopher Wilder abused and murdered. Now that I've gotten that off my chest, we can move on. On April 13th, 1984, Christopher Wilder stopped at a gas station in Colebrook, New Hampshire. Two state troopers, Leo Jellison and Wayne Fortier, at the gas station noticed Beth's Firebird and saw Wilder talking with an attendant. When approached by Jellison, Wilder frantically jumped into the car and grabbed his .357 Magnum. While Jellison struggled with Wilder, two shots went off. One shot first passed through Wilder before hitting Jellison in the chest. This shot had pierced Wilder's heart and killed him instantly. Jellison survived his injuries. Cheryl Bonaventura's body was discovered on May 3, 1984, and Michelle Korfman's body was found in Southern California on May 11, 1984. Rosario Gonzalez and Elizabeth Kenyon have never been found. Now, back to the investigation into Colleen's disappearance. Again, a tip had come in on April 12, 1984, that a girl near where Colleen lived had interacted with a man who she was positive was Christopher Wilder. The girl recalled Wilder driving away and turning onto Butler Boulevard, the street that Colleen lived on. Investigators did learn that Christopher Wilder had checked into a Howard Johnson hotel on March 15, 1984. The hotel was just minutes away from Colleen's beachside apartment. He had checked out before sunrise on March 16th. On April 19, 1984, police were notified that a body had been found in Ocala National Forest, less than an hour away from Daytona Beach. Police wanted to use Colleen's dental records to compare to the body, but were unsuccessful in obtaining them. Frances told police that Colleen had broken her arm 2 years prior, hoping that the evidence of the break could be used as an identifying factor. Police were able to obtain a copy of the X-ray. Detective Larry Lewis, the lead detective on Colleen's case, attended the autopsy of the body found in Ocala National Forest. However, the medical examiner was unable to find any evidence of a healed break in the arm. Hair samples from the items collected in Colleen's bedroom were also compared to the body. Testing concluded that there were no similarities between the samples and the hair on the deceased. Colleen's sister Margaret was asked to identify articles of clothing found at the scene, but she didn't recognize any of the items. It was determined that this body was not Colleen Orsborn, and this Jane Doe has still not been identified to this day. On April 6, 1984, another body had been found in a shallow grave near a lake in Orange County, about an hour away from Daytona Beach. Police investigating Colleen's case were not notified about this body until days later. The Jane Doe was estimated to be between 15 and 16 years old, approximately 5 foot 3 inches tall, and 110 pounds. These characteristics were all extremely similar to Colleen. The medical examiner concluded that the Jane Doe had been deceased for about 10 to 14 days at the time her body was found. There was still pink nail polish on her fingernails. Detectives sent a copy of the x-ray from when Colleen broke her arm, but the medical examiner concluded that there was no evidence of a previous break on this Jane Doe's arm either. Hair samples from Colleen's bedroom were again compared to this body, but it was determined that there was no match. It was conclusively determined by the medical examiner at the time that this body was also not the body of Colleen Orsborn. The Orange County Jane Doe was buried on a county plot, but the skull and mandible were stored and kept as evidence. Frances Orsborn passed away in 1989, never knowing what happened to her youngest daughter. In 2001, Bruce Orsborn, Colleen's brother, received an anonymous letter sent from New Hampshire. In the letter, the author stated that they killed Colleen in 1984 and left her body somewhere near the Tomoka River, which runs through the same county where Colleen lived. According to investigators, as well as Bruce, the author didn't seem to be familiar with the area, judging by the way he referred to particular locations. This led investigators to believe that they may have just been visiting Daytona Beach at the time. Again, when Colleen disappeared, spring break was just getting started, meaning thousands upon thousands of tourists in the area. The author of this disturbing letter also stated that they were dying, begging for forgiveness from Colleen's family. Attempts at forensic testing were made, but no fingerprints or other physical evidence could be obtained from the letter. The police used the postmark on the letter to determine which post office it had been sent from. They then placed an ad in the local newspaper from that area, asking the author to come forward. They never received a response. It's eventually concluded that the letter was nothing more than a twisted, cruel hoax. In 2004, Dr. Jan Garavaglia took over the medical examiner's office. She made it her goal to re-examine all of the Jane Does and ensure that attempts to identify them were thorough. DNA testing was in its infancy in 1984. Beyond comparing hair samples, there was very little else that could be done to compare DNA samples and find a match. In 2007, Dr. Garavaglia sent the mandible of the Orange County Jane Doe to the FBI, hoping that they would find a match to the DNA in their database. And again, this Jane Doe had been discovered on April 6, 1984, 23 years prior. In 2010, Dr. Garavaglia received the call she had long been hoping for. The FBI had gotten a hit on the Jane Doe, linking her to a woman from Daytona Beach. That woman was Margaret, Colleen's sister. She had provided her DNA in the hope that someday her DNA would match an unidentified body. The Jane Doe's mitochondrial DNA matched Margaret, meaning that the two were closely related. Margaret had received a call in January of 2011 from a reporter, asking if she was aware that the Orange County Jane Doe, found 27 years prior, was being re-examined. One artist's sketch caught Margaret's attention. The sketch was done as a reconstruction of what the Jane Doe might have looked like in life, and it was eerily similar to what Colleen looked like as a child. Dr. Garavaglia performed one final test. She compared Colleen's teeth in the photo on her missing poster to the teeth of the Jane Doe. She was confident that the body was in fact that of Colleen Orsborn. She also explains why the Jane Doe was likely determined not to be Colleen in the original investigation. Hair samples from Colleen's curling iron had been compared to the Jane Doe, and it was determined that there was no match. Dr. Garavaglia explains that this mistake was likely made because the original medical examiner did not consider the fact that Colleen was not the only person to use the curling iron. She had several friends who were all very likely to have used the curling iron before, meaning their hair could have been left behind. There was no way to confirm that Colleen was the only person to have used the curling iron. On July 20th, 2011, 27 years after Colleen Osborne disappeared, Dr. Garavaglia officially declared her deceased and is confident that the Jane Doe is indeed Colleen. It is still widely believed that Colleen Osborne was another victim of Christopher Wilder. However, that has not been definitively proven. So Colleen's family spent 27 years in the dark about where Colleen was or what may have happened to her, all because of a severe mistake and oversight by the original medical examiner. And Frances was never able to find out what became of her daughter. She passed away 22 years before the Orange County Jane Doe was confirmed to be Colleen. As for my personal thoughts on this case, I am definitely with the majority, as I believe that Christopher Wilder did indeed abduct and kill Colleen Osborne, but they will probably never be able to prove that. And that about wraps up this episode. So thank you for listening to the story of Colleen Osborne. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Crime Again Pod, and you can also like the Facebook page, Crime and Crime Again Podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
All because of a fancy bike?
It's not just a bike. Peloton makes treadmills too.
Nah, all treadmills are the same.
Our treadmills can adjust speed and incline automatically, so you never break your stride. Whether you're squeezing in a power walk or training for a marathon, Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try the Peloton Tread risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial. 92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92%? Because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.